Tuesday, February 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Syria agrees to the ceasefire plan brokered by the United States and Russia. A new report describes an increase in the use of child soldiers by the Islamic State.
It points towards a more strategic vision for the use of children and youth than we had previously thought.
And we hear about some prominent singers and musicians who skipped last week's Grammy Awards in Los Angeles. It's all ahead. Syria said Tuesday it accepts a ceasefire plan proposed by the United States and Russia that would begin Saturday. A government statement said the military will continue its operations against the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda-linked groups. The U.S.-Russia plan does not apply to those militants, and any other groups have until Friday to confirm their participation. The main Syrian opposition High Negotiations Committee said late Monday it agrees to the ceasefire as long as its demands for the lifting of sieges, delivery of humanitarian aid, and an end to the bombings of civilians are met. Both Moscow and Washington, part of the 17-nation International Syria Support Group, will spearhead a task force to work out details on the implementation of the ceasefire. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called the plan a long-awaited signal of hope. Ambassador David Mack, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Asia Affairs, now with the Middle East Institute, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he views the ceasefire as a very hopeful sign.
One can be skeptical. It's wise to be skeptical about ceasefire agreements in the Middle East, but for various reasons, some of them different at odds, but also some of them overlapping and complementary. Both Russia and the United States are keen to see a ceasefire that works. And frankly, I think this is the only way to relieve the suffering of the Syrian people. It's a first step, but it could get toward negotiations that would provide for some permanent resolution of the crisis.
Well, this cessation of hostilities apparently includes allowance of further attacks, such as airstrikes against Islamic State, Nusra, and other militant groups. Will this be a wedge that Russia may use to continue pounding rebels around Aleppo?
Certainly Russia is going to use it, but it's also noteworthy that the United States is going to continue to attack those kinds of groups. I think it has to be understood that the Syrian opposition would be wise to find a way to distance itself a little bit more from Jabhat al-Nusra. It's well known that it engages in tactical cooperation from time to time. This is playing with fire. These people are terrorists. They're considered terrorists by both Russia and the United States. So Syrian opposition groups shouldn't be surprised if engaging in cooperation with such groups might lead to a price that they would have to pay.
The announcement was received conditionally from the head, the chief coordinator, if you will, of the main Western-backed Syrian opposition known as the High Negotiations Committee. Riyad Hijab said that it ought to allow for the end of sieges and the allowance in of humanitarian aid.
I have a great respect for Riyad Hijab, and I do hope that they will be willing to work with this ceasefire, because I think it would be very unwise for the Syrian opposition to ignore the possibility that this could be an opening to considerable amount of humanitarian relief to the Syrian people. It's all very fine to establish your opposition to the Assad government. But if you were to pass up an opportunity to provide serious humanitarian relief to civilians who are in distress, would be unwise.
And Ambassador David Mack says the U.S. is not endangered by Russia's high profile in Syria. He says Moscow has longstanding interests in the Middle East, and they should not be viewed with suspicion in Washington as they were during the Cold War. He says Russia is also concerned about the presence of thousands of Russians and former Soviet passport holders in Syria fighting alongside militant groups like IS and Nusra. Well, Syria is one of the countries most affected by the Islamic State and its campaign of terror. A new report examines the use of child soldiers by IS. The report bases its conclusions on propaganda and eulogies issued over the past 13 months. Charlie Winter is Senior Research Associate at Georgia State University's Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative and is one of the authors of the report. I asked him about its conclusions.
Well, what's been particularly interesting about the featuring of children and youth in ISIS propaganda over the last 13 months is that it's accelerated quite sharply, and it's continuing to accelerate even now. The other thing of note is that ISIS appears to be bucking the child soldier norm, if you can forgive me for using that term, rather than using children and youth just to buoy its ranks, as many other militant organizations do. They just use children because they're easy to recruit, essentially. In this case, children are being used alongside adults. So they're not being used to replace adults that have been killed on the battlefield, for example. They're just being integrated into Islamic State's military campaign, just as the adults are. And that's significant, and it points towards a more strategic vision for the use of children and youth than we had previously thought.
What kind of vision is that, do you think?
Well, routinely you see in ISIS propaganda a discussion of the next generation of Mujahideen, something that appears in Derbek, the magazine, but also in a number of other formats as well. So you'll see training camps and schools and indoctrination centers. They feature a great deal in the broader corpus of ISIS propaganda. But what we're seeing here is they're being mobilized and actually used on the battlefield after a period of training. I mean, there's a recent emergence of a tactic called Ingimesi attacks, and this is where a group of individuals will embark on a suicide mission, which usually involves 2 to 3 children, 2 to 3 adolescents, I should say. And we're seeing a lot more of that recently. And what's important about training for this attack is it's something which isn't engaged in just by any fighter of ISIS. It's someone who has been trained in this particular tactic. And we're seeing the fruits of that being born before our eyes now.
Now, when you say children, do you mean children or are they teenagers or kind of what is the age range?
That's an important question. So we went for this study, we went for a slight modification of the United Nations definition of child soldier, which is any person of 18 years of age or under that is related or used in a military format, in a military setting by an organization. So the slight modification that we went for is saying 18 years of age or under. And that's because it's impossible to know for sure exactly how old the people are in these photographs, but we use child development theory and techniques to estimate their ages based on proportion of features on the face and things like that. But the age range of the individuals we're dealing with, so all 89, I'd say that it's between about 10 or 11 and 18.
Charlie Winter, Senior Research Associate at Georgia State University's Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative. He's one of the authors of a report on the Islamic State's increasing use of child soldiers. Well, joining me now is Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. Andrew, what's happening?
A lot of people on social media have pointed out recently that Facebook is expanding some of its video options, specifically one option to view video in 360 degrees. Now, this is confusing for a lot of people, saying, how can you view video on Facebook in that way? Well, we might have our answer now, finally. Seems that Mark Zuckerberg is looking at virtual reality as the next step. The Facebook CEO was speaking in Barcelona this past weekend, and he said, I've been waiting for this day to come when we can deliver this virtual reality experience. Today, this is now possible. That day is here. The idea being that virtual reality is the next social medium that he wants to explore, hence the option of view video in 360 degrees. Now, he would allow people to do this through devices that they would connect and kind of wear as glasses on their head with their phone plugged in. It'll be interesting to see how Facebook continues to use this. Some news organizations have used video like this, this virtual reality video, to show on the scene during refugee crisis and other major events. But it'll be interesting to see how a social medium like Facebook might use that video. We also have a report from the George Washington University's program on extremism, which says that all of the activity against ISIS or the Islamic State group on Twitter is actually working. The number of ISIS Twitter accounts is actually decreasing, and according to their study, the amount of impact and reach that those Twitter accounts are having, those are also decreasing. So it seems that in this ongoing battle against ISIS social media, It seems that ISIS is failing. They're not opening as many new social media accounts as they were previously. Of course, social media has been a huge ground for this battle against the Islamic State. They've been very good at trying to recruit people through social media and connect with people through social media. But that trend may be discontinuing.
Here's Science in a Minute.
UK researchers looked to the bat for inspiration in developing wings that could be used in constructing a new generation of insect or bird-sized aircraft called micro-air vehicles. They say their new innovation will allow the tiny aircraft to eventually travel much longer distances than currently possible and make them more inexpensive to run. Scientists at the UK's University of Southampton say that their new wings, which they liken to artificial muscles, have improved aerodynamic properties and can quickly respond to various flying conditions by simply changing their shape. While this new technology uses no mechanical parts, it does incorporate electroactive polymers that use electrical current to modify the aerodynamic characteristics of the wing structure. Micro-air vehicles, which can be as small as 15 centimeters, can be used in various commercial and military applications. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, well, some prominent show business names did not participate in last week's Grammy Awards. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi is in Washington for 3 days of talks with U.S. officials amid rising tensions over China's actions in the South China Sea. The visit comes as the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies says China has installed radar facilities on a reef in the contested Spratlys after Beijing acknowledged earlier this month it stationed air defense missiles in the Paracels. On Monday, U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner called on Beijing to halt its militarization program.
What we want to see China do has been made clear multiple times that we want to see it stop its militarization activities, its settlement activities in the South China Sea. All it does is escalate tensions. There needs to be a diplomatic mechanism in place that allows these claims, territorial claims, to be settled in a peaceful way. In the meantime, we're going to continue to press China to de-escalate and to stop its militarization.
Beijing has asserted what it calls its historic right to much of the South China Sea, claims also made by many of its Southeast Asian neighbors, including Taiwan, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei. A U.S. Navy destroyer sailed to within 12 nautical miles of Triton Island in the Paracel group last month. U.S. defense officials said the mission was conducted under freedom of navigation, which gives every nation the right to sail through crucial international navigation lanes. Beijing denounced the U.S. action as a provocation and vowed there would be consequences. On the eve of Mr. Wang's visit, the Chinese foreign ministry said China was deploying necessary limited defensive facilities on its own territory, much as the U.S. does defending Hawaii. International Edition's Victor Beatty asked Ankit Panda, co-editor of the Asia-Pacific publication The Diplomat, to react to Beijing's view.
I think it shows that China is simply trying to prod the U.S. a bit on this point. It's clearly upset about the freedom of navigation patrols. In January, the United States carried out a freedom of navigation patrol in the Paracel Islands, but there's a clear difference. Woody Island, the Paracel Islands, and the South China Sea are disputed territories. China claims that they are its by historical right and the fact that it administers them. Hawaii, by contrast, is a fully incorporated U.S. state and recognized as such internationally. So there's just a variety of issues that make that comparison a little bit problematic, in my view.
Well, the U.S. State Department on Monday said the U.S. would, quote, press China to de-escalate and stop its militarization. There's no backing off from Washington's position on this either.
Absolutely. And I think that strikes the core of the issue, which is that the United States and China have a very different idea of what militarization in the South China Sea means. Curiously, from China's perspective, the positioning of surface-to-air missiles, for example, on Woody Island and the Paracel Islands aren't a form of militarization. They're a form of necessary national defense. From the United States' perspective, freedom of navigation patrols, sending U.S. guided missile destroyers into the 12 nautical mile zone of China's islands and artificial islands in the South China Sea are also not a form of militarization. So the two sides really have no clear agreement on what constitutes militarization.
And apparently the U.S. is going to encourage Australia and other nations in the Asia-Pacific region to conduct what it conducts, freedom of navigation patrols, within 12 nautical miles of those contested islands.
And there's a possibility that these might eventually become multilateral activities, which would also upset China quite a bit, particularly since it would convey that China is essentially being singled out by the United States and its network of allies in the Asia Pacific.
Are we heading on a slow path towards some sort of confrontation, or can this be resolved peacefully?
I think that one event to watch later this year will be the resolution of the ongoing case in The Hague at the Permanent Court of Arbitration between China and the Philippines. A decision in that case is expected in late May, and it is very likely that the international court will rule that China's nine-dash line claim in the South China Sea, the long cow tongue-shaped line that essentially encompasses 90% of the waters there, is illegitimate. And that will bring us to an interesting point, because China will be in transgression of international law. China signed the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and once it's ruled to be in violation of that with its claims in the South China Sea, it'll be interesting to watch how Beijing's behavior changes.
And Ankit Panda says while the U.S. and China share common interests in a stable Asia and advancing a bilateral investment treaty, tensions over the South China Sea and what to do about North Korea's nuclear and missile programs will likely cast a pall over this week's talks in Washington. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The Grammy Awards ceremony is, of course, one of the biggest annual highlights in music. Just as fun as it is to see the stars together at one time is to talk about who didn't show up. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins International Edition's Jim Stevenson to fill us in on the most notable unseen performers at the Grammys.
We're going to talk about the stars who didn't come out at the 2016 Grammy Awards, Jim. First of all, Drake. His name was promoted during a Grammy ad that aired during the Super Bowl. However, apparently that was news to Drake, because he went on Twitter and he wrote, "I'm not performing at the Grammy Awards, but hey, it's the thought that counts." So that was pretty cut and dried. Drake was not going to be at the Grammys, and that was that. Lauryn Hill. Things get a little more interesting here. Now, Lauren, of course, has a fairly extensive Grammy history. She released that fantastic album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, that won her multiple Grammys in the 90s. Billboard reported that Lauryn was to have duetted with The Weeknd. However, she issued a statement saying that the Grammys announcement was premature. She had been doing concerts the previous weekend. Furthermore, no performance was ever confirmed. That's how Lauryn Hill explained her absence. The most interesting of them all is Rihanna, because she was actually there at the venue, the Staples Center, for rehearsals. She had confirmed that she was going to sing her new song, Kiss It Better. She turned up for rehearsals, and then E! News reported that doctors had ordered Rihanna to go on 48-hour vocal rest due to a case of bronchitis. Supposedly, she had been on antibiotics for 3 days, and it still hadn't knocked out the infection. However, 2 days earlier, on February 13th, Rihanna had sung for Lionel Richie at the Music Cares Person of the Year event, and a video exists of her singing Say You, Say Me, and, you know, she sounds pretty good. TMZ quotes unnamed sources as saying Rihanna was screaming and hysterical before she walked out of the rehearsals. Those sources also say Rihanna left with Lauryn Hill, so Lauryn apparently made it out there too, and that Rihanna wasn't happy at all about how the rehearsals went. So we have two obviously conflicting stories here. And then as far as other Grammy no-shows go, I suppose we could mention Kanye West, who tweeted that he was boycotting the Grammys until they gave him the Album of the Year award, which would have been impossible in any event because his new album was not released during the eligibility period. So I think we can say that that was just Kanye blowing smoke because he's been all over Twitter lately.
Well, and then we would have had another Kanye-Taylor Swift incident.
Well, it was interesting to note that when Taylor Swift received Album of the Year, her second Album of the Year for 1989, she had a lot of other people on stage with her, and they were sort of forming a protective perimeter around her. I was live tweeting the Grammys, and I was saying, where is Kanye? Does anybody know where Kanye is? Because, of course, what famously happened back in 2009 at the MTV Awards when Kanye bum-rushed Taylor when she received her award. So there it is, some of the more notable no-shows at the 2016 Grammys.
Ray McDonald, our Top 20 Countdown host, and we thank you so much for joining us, Ray. Be sure to follow Ray on Twitter, by the way. What is that stream, Ray?
Ray on the Hits.
Follow him. Thanks so much for joining.
You got it, Jim. Thanks. Quack.
And that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Department of Energy Assistant Secretary for International Affairs Jonathan Elkind recently joined Pakistan's Ministry of Planning, Ministry of Water and Power, and Ministry of Petroleum and Natural Resources to announce the launch of a multi-agency technical assistance program designed to support Pakistan's energy development efforts. The three-year effort, conducted in partnership with the U.S. Agency for International Development, will bring experts from the U.S. Department of Energy National Laboratories together with Pakistani energy experts to develop strategies and resources for integrated energy system planning, energy efficiency, and promoting private investment in renewable energy. The program is a component of the U.S.-Pakistan Clean Energy Partnership, announced by President Barack Obama and Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in October 2015. The partnership aims to develop 3,000 megawatts of new private sector clean power projects in Pakistan, which would directly benefit more than 30 million Pakistanis. The new partnership continues joint efforts by the United States and Pakistan to address Pakistan's energy needs and includes support from several U.S. government agencies. The United States and Pakistan have cooperated on energy issues since 2009 under the Energy Working Group, established through the U.S.-Pakistan Strategic Dialogue. Recognizing the critical importance of increasing energy security and access in a clean, sustainable manner, the United States has committed more than $1 billion to date to support energy sector investments and reforms in cooperation with the government of Pakistan. Our cooperative efforts have made over 1,750 additional megawatts available to the national grid, powering the homes and businesses of 19.4 million Pakistanis and increasing the annual revenue of Pakistani distribution companies by over $418 million. The United States is committed to our partnership with Pakistan. We are addressing energy challenges and working together on our shared global energy priorities, including the opportunities presented by a growing renewable energy market, said Assistant Secretary Elkind. We look forward to having American and Pakistani experts collaborate in this critical arena.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.